Hello, and welcome to episode 122 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I am joined as always by Rick Keight, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
And this week, we are also joined by Lawrence Eppard, who is an associate professor of sociology at Shippensburg University in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, and he hosts the Utterly Moderate podcast, which, like The Ethical Life, is part of the Lee Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us, Lawrence, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott and Rick. I'm a fan of your show, and it's nice to meet you both in person, even if it's over the internet. So,
well, anymore, this is almost in person, or maybe the new normal a little bit.
That's right.
The three of us are each going to make two predictions for the new year, and at the end of the show, Rick and I will revisit the predictions we made at this time last year, and Professor Eppard will give us a grade on each of those predictions. We have a lot to get to this episode, so let's jump right in. And Rick, let's start with you. What is your first prediction for the year 2024?
This is a prediction I wish I wasn't making, but it is that conflicts in the Middle East are going to escalate as Israel's pragmatic relations with neighboring countries corrodes. As you know, Israel's had long-standing treaties and fairly good relations with both Egypt and Jordan, plus fairly pragmatic relationships with a number of other countries in the Middle East because of their common stance against Iran. But what's happening, you can see specific things that are happening in Egypt and Jordan for different reasons, with refugees from Gaza going into Egypt, and The administration there has always tried to kind of accommodate Hamas and not pursue a policy of trying to destroy them. They're being pressured to collaborate with Israel, and it's not a popular stance. And then in Jordan, relationships haven't been good for quite a while, and what's going on in the war is increasing popular antagonism against Israel. This really came to mind a few days ago when I saw a number of different videos that were being shared by Palestinians in both the West Bank and in Gaza about what's going on there. And it occurs to me that Israel could very well win the war against Hamas and succeed in wiping out Hamas, and yet lose the public relations battle, and especially end up antagonizing to a much greater extent all of the neighboring countries, and in a way that for their long-term future is really devastating. I just don't see any good solution to this conflict. And I think what's happened with the availability of social media and the widespread availability of cell phones, images are getting directly out. It's not mediated by the news anymore. There's no gatekeepers, right? What's happening on the ground is getting out to everyone right now. And I don't see any way of Israel coming out of this with people being sympathetic to what's going on.
And there was talk up until this summer, and of course until the terrible attacks this fall, that there was going to be some optimism around peace in the Middle East, and that there was talk about Israel normalizing relations with some long Arab foes. And some people think that because of that may have led some of the actions that Hamas took. So if we were close a few months ago, we're clearly much further away now. And I know some people think as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is in charge in Israel, it seems like there's a hard path to peace. Is that something both of you kind of agree with?
Yeah, I would think it's a hard path to peace. And one of the things we're seeing is governments are responding much more to popular pressure, because it's not so much that people are better informed, it's that they have access to information that they're sharing with one another that's no longer controlled in the way it used to be. And I look at this and I think Hamas was just a lot smarter and about like a long-term strategy. Any kind of harsh response towards them is going to generate this widespread popular anger towards Israel. And I think that's what's happening. That's not, I'm not stating this as my considered view of how people should feel about this conflict. It's just what I see, what is happening. And I think it's happening here in the United States as we're seeing student protests on campuses. We're seeing what's happening in Michigan. Imagine that increased 100-fold to all the Muslim countries in the Middle East. And I don't see how Israel comes out of this.
And to your point about no gatekeepers, I mean, it seems to me, and again, I'm very, very limited in my knowledge of this conflict, but the power imbalance between Israel and Palestine in terms of, you know, munitions and technology and those sorts of things, in any conflict, those images are always going to look worse. The devastation is always going to look worse in Gaza, right? So yeah. I don't see how they win that public relations war.
See, in the past, they would have been able to control a lot of the images that got out and the news stories that got out, right? There's no control anymore.
Right.
Well, we will keep that one and compare next year, Rick, although unfortunately, I'm afraid that one is probably going to be correct. Moving on here, the next two topics, one for me and one from Lawrence, are both around the presidential election. I don't think either of us are going to make predictions about the presidential outcome, but I will make, well, maybe it's a bit of a provocative prediction, is that I went back and looked, and in 2020, which in case of those of you may not remember, that was Trump and Biden, the turnout was 66% nationwide, and that's the highest voter turnout in any national election since the year 1900. My prediction for 2024 is the turnout will be considerably lower. I'm saying that the turnout will be less than 62%. Again, that's down only 4 percentage points, but in a nation, that is millions and millions of people who are sitting this out. Why this is I read a recent poll that talked about the really have been significant shifts in party affiliation over the past, I guess, two or three election cycles now, where more higher propensity voters have been brought in the Democratic fold. I mean, I think in the 90s and even into the 2000s, it was the Republicans who traditionally had the voters who would turn out all the time for every election, not just the presidential years. And since Donald Trump has come out on the political scene, that seems to be a bit different. And I think that would possibly be a challenge for him. Again, we're assuming he's the nominee going forward. And there was a recent poll I mentioned said right now, Biden, you know, who is having some not so great poll numbers, leads by 6 points among voters who participated in the 2020 election. And while Trump holds an overwhelming 22-point lead among those who did not vote in 2020, I just think that whether or not you like Donald Trump, whether or not you like Joe Biden, these are two men most American voters know well and also may not think are probably the best people to have at the top of the ticket for each party. And I think there'll be a lot of disinterest, and I think we will see that in a lower turnout. I'd be curious from the thoughts for both of you.
If I had to put money one way or the other, I think you've put it in the right direction, and I'll assume your political analysis is correct.
And do you think, I mean, I picked the number 62. I think that I'd have to go back and look, but I think that was about what it was when we had the Clinton-Trump election, you know, back in 2016, wouldn't it have been? I guess I'll be curious to see. Rick, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you knew what the numbers were for the...
Well, you tell me your thoughts and I'll look that up.
One of the things that political campaign managers try to do is really motivate the base, because it's more about turning out the people who are already in support of a candidate than persuading people who typically don't vote and haven't made up their minds, right? I'm not sure there's going to be many people who haven't made up their minds in this one. It's just going to be who can turn people out. And it seems to me there's just a lack of energy. I'm certainly feeling pretty discouraged by this. Most of the people I know are discouraged about the prospect of Trump v. Biden. So how do you create energy? If you're a campaign manager for either one of these, how do you do it?
I was looking at one of the focus groups done by Sarah Longwell over at the Bulwark. And that was something that even among Trump voters, I was shocked by, was just sort of an exhaustion with this whole dynamic and with this the competition between those two.
And to answer your question, it was 59%. I almost wonder if my 62% prediction is a little high. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's closer to 60%. And of course, the obvious question, and if this proves to be true, is does that help the Democrats or does that help the Republicans? And I guess I'm not sure I have a real solid idea there. I don't know if either of you do.
My thought process is I saw the same poll you saw. I think that was the New York Times. Is that the
Correct.
One of the ones who participated in the last election versus those that did not. And my thought process is my very, unreliable elementary thought process here is if there is low turnout, then it's going to be more of those voters who were a part of the last election. And so we can kind of trust the polling numbers more. But again, that's my untrained eye.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting, and I'm sure you would all agree that there was, and this was mostly at the state house level across the country, but many states, mostly Republican-led states, put some voter ID laws in and some other things that Democrats were saying, this is making it more difficult to vote. And I think at the time, the skeptical view would be Republicans wanted to make sure that obviously there wasn't fraud, but also to maybe make it a little tougher for those occasional voters and thinking that the Republicans who know how to vote are going to go there no matter what. I think Trump's maybe turned that around a little bit. And I think some of those occasional voters are oftentimes more Trump-focused voters. And it'll be interesting to see if some of those restrictions for the people who rarely vote and then they show up at the polls and get turned away. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Or they don't vote because they can't drop off early ballots, that sort of thing. I mean, it tends to be seniors who, overall by percentage favor Trump, that most of those restrictions are going to hit. And so that could be a big mistake in a very close election for Republicans, I'm saying.
Staying on the election, Lawrence, I know your first prediction for the new year is also looking ahead toward next fall.
Yeah, I mean, my prediction is not all that. It's a pretty easy one. I think it's very likely to happen. I think our democracy is going to experience another pretty severe shock in the 2024 presidential election. And so I would encourage everybody to go back and listen if you have forgotten or if you never listened to it. Listen to the call with Trump and Raffensperger. Go back and look at, the conversations he had with state legislators flying him to the White House. And there was just a whole lot of pressure across a number of fronts, from the local all the way to the federal level. And I sort of naively thought before this era of our politics, that there were all of these guardrails and there were all these checks and balances and these security systems that would kick into place if people tried to mess with our democracy at that level. And I think what a lot of us found, and you guys can disagree with me if you'd like and educate me on this, but I think what a lot of us found was the institutions are somewhat fragile. And it really took a few people with courage to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to be a part of this. As an example, Mike Pence. So, Mike Pence to me seems like he makes a very obvious decision about what to do, not to go along with this, fraudulent electors thing. But then you go back and you read the accounts of what he was thinking about, and he was really kind of wavering. And again, it took a couple really important people not to give in to this for our democracy to hold. And I don't know how long our democracy can take that kind of sustained assault. And that's just keep banking on, the courts and a few key people holding up. And so I don't think, in my own personal opinion, which is why I made the prediction, I think there's a high likelihood it's going to face similar pressures this time, even though Trump's not the incumbent, so he doesn't have the same type of levers to pull. I think he's going to have a lot of the same forces working against democracy this time. I just hope it holds.
I mean, although one ray of sunshine, I suppose, is that in a lot of it in response to the confusion around Mike Pence and the certification process in the Senate, the House and Senate, and Biden signed into law, I'm gonna fumble the name here a little bit, but it's an act that basically makes it easier and more streamlined and gives more direction to how those electoral votes are counted to hopefully avoid something like that in the past. And I guess the only other positive note I would sound is that, you know, no matter who you talk to, the last election was close, right? I mean, I think we can agree on that. But all of the challenges, and many of them, frankly, pretty ridiculous challenges that were made by Trump and his team, were quickly dismissed by our court system. And there was not one or two that sort of hung out there. And it could have been a disorganized team that was leading this charge, and maybe it'll be more organized next year. But it did seem like the courts did the duty that they're supposed to do. And I guess I think that gives me the biggest sense of hope that if we get to something as close or closer election than we had last go round, that we might be okay. Rick, are you taking my sunnier outlook, or do you think I'm just being a little too optimistic?
I'm not as worried about a destabilizing assault as just the steady destabilizing corrosion of institutions. And we just saw the Colorado Supreme Court yesterday declare that Trump could not appear in the primary ballot. This is being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That court's going to be in a no-win situation. They have to hear it. If they don't hear it, it opens the doors for other states to do the same thing, which would effectively rule Trump out of the election. A lot of people are going to see that as an illegitimate denial of their candidate. If the Supreme Court hears it, then they're in this position of getting involved in who the public elects to be president in ways that the framers of our Constitution never envisioned, that the Supreme Court would have to exercise that kind of power. And so when our institutions are assuming power that's beyond their intended function in really divisive ways, it just further corrodes their authority. And the only authority they have anyway is that we believe in them.
You know, again, it's hard to game this out and what will happen in the fall. But if it is another close election and some key thing goes to the U.S. Supreme Court,
like a hanging chad,
kind of like, yes, we're old enough to remember that. I guess what I'm trying to speculate is that in the past, the Trump team has had more non-traditional, maybe a polite way to say it, approaches to the law. And as we know, last time, all of those were struck down by various courts across this land. And if one of those sort of oddball pieces makes it to the Supreme Court, well, I mean, most people accurately believe that that is a right-leaning court. And to me, that is a good thing, assuming they do the right thing and follow the Constitution and follow the law. Because if it were a court made up of all lefties on the court, well, I think that would be tougher for the people on the Republican side to take. And because of where the court sits now, and again, I think there's plenty to criticize about them, but if they were to somehow uphold an election for Democrats, I think that would, that would put us in a little stronger position as a country. Does that make sense, or am I just again being a little too optimistic in a situation that probably doesn't seem to warrant that?
To your point about the country held, right? So all those 60 cases or whatever, you know, the courts played their part, and the election went the way that it was supposed to go. So in that sense, I agree. I do think that the next election will go the way that it's supposed to go. Whoever wins, I think will assume the office. I just had two things that I think are important to think about. Number one, with all of the changes to the way the electoral count can and cannot be abused, I think there's still a lot of room at the state legislature level for a lot of you know, really nefarious stuff. So that's one thing. But the second thing is, I agree with you that democracy held. And so Joe Biden won the election and he assumed the office, and that was what was supposed to happen. My concern is not really that. My concern is not that somebody will make it into office who didn't deserve to be in office. It's that there'll be so much chaos like there was last time, and so much misinformation and disinformation that our country, like last time, will come out much, much, much sicker of a country. You know, we were in much worse shape after all of that happened. And so, again, even if it holds and the right person makes it into office, we're more tribal, we're more partisan. Our institutions are suffering, as Rick pointed out. So that's my concern.
Yeah, I think that's right.
We'll move on to the next prediction here in a moment, but I'm going to take my role as the host and put you both on the spot here, just before we step away from politics. Do you think this fall we will have and continue the tradition of debates again, that the candidates are Biden and Trump, or if it happens to be somebody else on the stage? Do you think we will have them, or do you think we won't? Real
quick answer. Good question. I'm going to make Rick go first. That's a good question.
I think we won't. I don't think either candidate wants them.
I would agree with Rick, but Lawrence, are you going to join us, or are you going to go on the other way there?
I think I want to agree with you, because that seems to be the direction that we're going. It didn't seem to be something you could just kind of shrug off before. There'd be a huge political penalty. All of the things in the past that seemed to be no-go zones and third rails and political suicide, the landscape has changed so much. And we're so partisan that there's so many things you can do now that, as long as it doesn't make your base angry, you're fine, right? And so if either one of them decided, I could see Biden making a case for, I can't debate this guy, he'll lie, he'll do this, he'll do that. I could see Trump, you know, making a case on the other side, and both of their bases being totally fine with it, and so they don't pay any kind of political price. So I think I'm leaning towards your prediction.
And I think, like, if there's any good news there, at least I think most Americans have formed an opinion about those two gentlemen, and, you know, I guess we do seem to know them well.
Well, yeah. And you, Scott, you made that point. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah,
you made that point earlier about these are very well known candidates. There's hardly anybody out there who doesn't have a pretty hardened position on them. And so all the people out there saying, "Well, we're far away from the election, right? There's time for these polls to change."
Yeah.
Well, how much will they really change when we've known these people for decades?
That is why I think these polls, 11 months before election day, are a little more calcified than probably ones where there's a nominee folks don't really know that well.
Yeah, I mean, Biden's been in Congress his whole life, and it's the Christmas season here, and I'm watching Home Alone with my kids, and there's Donald Trump in Home Alone 2 in the hotel with Kevin McAllister. So these are well-known. People have very strong opinions about them.
Well, we have three more predictions to get to, and the clock is ticking, so we better move on. Rick, we'll start the next round with you. What is your next prediction for the new year?
Well, we also saw the congressional hearings at which the presidents of Harvard, MIT, and Penn had those disastrous and embarrassing responses. I'm predicting that leading universities especially will see free speech conflicts continue in the coming year, and there are going to be calls and actually laws passed at both state and federal levels to try to exert control over speech codes on universities.
Now, both of you spend your professional time on campuses, so I'll let you kind of lead this discussion a little bit. But I think the two questions I would be curious about are, one, you know, I keep hearing stories, and I don't know if this happens on your individual campuses, but I'm sure you've heard this other places, where the campus or a student group brings in a speaker who may not be everyone's cup of tea and gets sort of shouted down and you know, get the heckler's veto, as it's called, sort of pushes that person off stage and the hecklers sort of claim victory. Is that something that you think will continue or should be regulated? And two, I think a term that you hear a lot on campuses over the past, I'll say decade, is making sure there are safe spaces for students. And I think that is part of the reason we have these free speech concerns and limitations at times. And I'm just curious if you think you can still, if we've maybe gone too far in ensuring that a time where you should have some intellectual, intellectual rigor, intellectual danger, possibly even, and maybe making sure safe spaces aren't quite as important as maybe we once thought.
Since universities have traditionally, they've been places, and I'm going back many decades here, places where there was an education for citizenship, and that was regarded as like one of the fundamental purposes. That's why, like in Wisconsin, there's the Wisconsin idea that there's a, you need universities to educate citizens for the good of communities in various places. And part of that means talking about the things that citizens need to talk about in the process of working out what the common good is. And I have seen during the course of my career, from the point, from the time that I began as an undergraduate student towards where I'm teaching now, is most universities really abandoned that entirely as part of the thought of what they're trying to do. They're not educating for citizenship. They're educating for the advancement of individual careers. And so free speech becomes like what you use to advance, to voice your interest. And so then they become places of protests in which you kind of, you work out protests and you do it not always in organized protests, but you make your voice known. That's very different from a place of dialogue where the purpose is to reach a common understanding and negotiation. And so we're not teaching those sorts of things. So like no matter what people think of as the what the Constitution says about free speech or anything else, I don't see there any kind of popular idea on campus, either from students or from faculty or administrators, of the universities being any place else than locations where conflict gets voiced. I don't know. I didn't really answer your question. I just went off in another rant. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I'll answer one of your questions, and then I will also rant because I'm taking Rick's lead here. So, but to your question about whether we've gone too far as safe spaces, I'd say yes. There's a great quote in one of Adam Grant's books. I think it's called Think Again, but he's quoting somebody else, and I can't remember who he's quoting. But he says something to the effect of, you know, all of us should be able to look back at ourselves a year ago and say how stupid we were a year ago. And if you don't say that, you've had a bad year, right? You haven't learned, you haven't developed and grown as a person. And I wholeheartedly agree with that, especially for college students, right? So if you're not learning something in a given year while you're here, why are you here, right? I mean, what are you getting out of this experience? And so I do think, look, you know, should colleges be a place where you are physically under threat? Of course not. And I don't think we ever would have allowed that. But it is a place where you should be intellectually uncomfortable, because human beings do not reason unemotionally. We are very emotionally invested in the things that we believe. We like to be smart. We like to be right. We like for our groups to look good. You know, many of the things that we think about, especially about social issues, trigger emotional responses because you're talking about groups that you belong to and you're talking about firmly held beliefs and those sorts of things. And so to be uncomfortable means that you are getting a more nuanced understanding of those priors. And that's a good thing. And so you should be intellectually uncomfortable. And I do believe, to your question, Scott, we've gone too far in one direction of not providing that kind of space for students to struggle with new information. I just want to say one thing. So here's my rant portion of this response, which is, I know for a fact that if I were to say to my colleagues, I'm a social scientist, and so we are a very leftist, our disciplines are very leftist and quite honestly, very activist. And I know for a fact that if I said to my colleagues, if you found a discipline that was 40-1, Republican to Democrat, 40-1, if you found a discipline where you had never, ever in your entire life met a Democrat, you'd only met conservatives, only met Republicans in the discipline, do you think they'd have blind spots? do you think there'd be questions they weren't asking, you know, interpretations they weren't considering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Of course, the answer would be yes. Of course, they would believe that. That circumstance does exist in the reverse. Sociology is 40-1, liberal to conservative. No matter how you slice it, I don't care how partisan you are, how uncomfortable you are with the other side, we do not have a monopoly on truth on our side of the aisle. And so there are questions we aren't asking, there are perspectives we aren't considering, there are interpretations we are avoiding. This is a problem because this is worse than it was in the past. And sociology is not the only one. The ones that are considered bad, like psychology, are still like 17-1. This situation is in desperate need of remedy. I don't think there's any question about that. We have to figure out a way to become less partisan, less biased, less political, less activist at universities. Here's the problem. So I agree. I can't remember which one of you made the prediction that, I think it was Rick, that there was going to be some laws coming down the pike here and some policies. I don't think there's any question that universities need to be fixed in this regard. My problem is the people who are going to do it are not honest brokers, right? So Christopher Rufo is not a good faith actor, right? Now, he brings a lot of really important things to light. He unearths documents and PowerPoint presentations and workshops that I wouldn't have known about, and I'm horrified by when I see them, right? So he's doing work that's important, but the kinds of remedies we need aren't going to be good. They're going to be remedies just on the other side, right? So let's restrict universities in a way that pleases the right rather than actually fixing the problem.
And those external constraints, whatever they happen to be, won't fix the problem of you know, the problem is, as you pointed out, you know, that 40-1 ratio, that's a culture problem. That's not a political problem. So a political fix, you know, some rules requiring who gets to say what or who has to say what, that sort of solution isn't going to fix that problem. And so I'm certainly not saying it's a good thing that that universities are going to become more regulated. I think that's going to be bad for universities, but it's going to happen anyway.
Oh, yeah. And I didn't take your prediction as saying, you know, Mike thinks that, you know, Christopher Rufo should have the reins here. It's already happening, right? So it's going to be ramped up in the coming year. And here's the problem is that, in my opinion, we aren't going to do it if we aren't forced to, right? So I think it's necessary that we reform ourselves. And because we're not going to do it, someone else is going to do it. And unfortunately, those people are not going to do it in a nuanced way. They're going to come in like a hammer looking for nails and, you know, probably just disrupt the enterprise even more.
Well, we'll move on to my second prediction for the new year. And it's a little timely for a couple of reasons. Back on May 15th, 2014, or just about 10 years ago, a product called Google Glasses made it to the public, and there was a lot of worry about this because of privacy issues, and there was people thought that these were just going to take off and just be everywhere. And I know a lot of people, and I'm not a Luddite by any stretch, but I never knew anyone, at least that I knew, had this product. The technology was not, it was good, it wasn't great. They were pretty expensive. And of course, there were these privacy concerns. And for a lot of different reasons, these just never really took off in the way that Google imagined them to. But my prediction for the new year is that we are going to have these glasses, maybe not by Google, make a comeback. And there's a story I found just a couple of weeks ago where Facebook is working on a new version along with Ray-Ban, of course, the large sunglass maker, which are trying to get these marketed to more people more widely. The prices come down. The technology has improved. And the other thing that's another important piece from 10 years ago is, once you have this video that you may want to embarrass somebody with or maybe show off for all the good reasons, the way to share that, the channels, the platforms to share that are much deeper than there were 10 years ago. And I think we are about to enter a new age of privacy concerns because, yeah, you can. We all know the power of cell phone video, and sometimes that can be used for good. But it's not impossible, but it's probably more difficult to record someone on your cell phone without them knowing. But if there's just simply a pair of glasses, like, well, I can see on the Zoom call glasses we're all wearing, I can't tell enough if any of you are have a camera hidden in there. And there's a lot of places and a lot of interactions we see and are part of every day that the people around us probably don't want being recorded. And I just think we're about to have a whole lot of new privacy questions around these. Should this, is this something that you think sounds true to you? And is this something you might be worried about as we approach 2024?
I have a very short observation. I remember 6-7 years ago seeing a prototype of the Microsoft HoloLens, and they're predicting that within 2 years, it would make LED screens obsolete on, you know, laptops and cell phones and everything else, because they would get increasingly, you know, portable, and people would be able to wear them in ways that, you just put on a pair of goggles instead of using a screen and so forth. And of course, none of that happened. They'd become kind of an item for gamers, but like they're not in widespread use. They're not used for Teams meetings and things like that that they envision. So that makes me kind of skeptical of your. I wonder if they become kind of a novelty item for a few people and they develop a real specialized use, but don't really become popular.
It's, you know, mass marketed and everybody's wearing the newest Google glasses. I'm not sure about that, but I do think it's plausible that technological advances, and I'm not sure what the term is here. I know there's a term for this, the way in which, the time between technological advances shortens as time moves on. But it does seem very likely to me with AI and with, all these different technologies that are moving at such a rapid speed, that there could be a technology that could allow you to see things you shouldn't see and catalog things you shouldn't catalog in a way that has some very serious privacy concerns, even if only 1% of people in your town are using it, right? If they're using it behind closed doors in spaces they shouldn't be using them, bathrooms, whatever the case may be. I certainly think it's plausible that it could advance to that level where it causes problems, even if it's not a large portion of the population.
And we have to move on to the last prediction here in just a second, but I'll just ask both of you real quick, because you're both around young people on campuses all the time. I think a lot of people's perception is that young people, college age, don't have the same expectation of privacy that maybe people 10, 20, 30 years ago had. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I could answer that question, but I would like, you want some comic relief?
Sure.
Either one of you want to, I'll just, you guys guess. I actually polled my students the other day and I asked them what their number one source of news was. You guys want to guess what it was?
I'm going to, and this is college age students, I am going to, I'll say TikTok.
Rick?
I would agree. TikTok, I would think.
It was TikTok, and I almost had an aneurysm right there in class.
Well, I just know because I've asked my students the same thing, and I was amazed. Like, a few of them said Instagram, not too many, though. But it was all social media, pretty much.
Sorry, Scott, that was off topic.
No, that's okay. Well, that'll point us up to a topic here at the end of the show. But before we get to the end of the show, we have one more prediction. And, Loris, you kind of prefaced this by saying you had kind of a dreary prediction about the election, but a more positive prediction about something else. Are you sure this is positive?
Well, it could go either way. I'm hoping it's positive. But I am just awed by the James Webb Telescope and even, other telescopes that aren't the most prominent like James Webb, but just the crazy number of images and revelations that we're getting and the way that scientists are able to use them to make new estimates and to produce new studies. And It just, I've had this sense, and that this is not very scientific. It's not very empirical. It is just a sense that I get. It's a, as the young people say, it's a vibe that I'm getting, that we're on the verge of a major discovery in space, whether that is man-made technologies that they notice out in the universe somewhere, or whether that's, you know, dark matter, you know, proof of dark matter, or, you know, some other major discovery. It just seems like as we go farther and farther out into space with better and better technologies, it seems like we're on the cusp of something major. And, you know, unrelated to this, you see things like, you know, fusion power, and, you know, just, it seems like we're on the cusp of something really big. And when it comes to space in particular, I think that maybe it's not next year, but I wanted to give a positive prediction. So I'll say, yeah, 2024, we're going to see a major prediction. I think we'll reorient us and how we think about the universe.
And we've all, I mean, there's only been, you know, 1,000 movies made about such things. And they often,
I hope it's not a HAL level, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I mean, but do you think people, well, it's hard to pin you down on this, because we aren't exactly sure what this discovery is, but assuming it is transcendent, like you predict, do you think people will be excited about that? Because it may change how they look at their world, beyond their world, their faith. It can challenge a lot of things that people hold pretty closely.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, and you know, your point at the beginning of this question, which is, you know, are you sure it's going to be positive? It would depend on the discovery, right? I mean, there's some discoveries that I think would be just totally awe-inspiring and could unite us at least for 5 seconds.
Here's the thing about that. I think you're probably right. And I think there could be a major discovery made that almost nobody understands, because the language of physics now is so esoteric. It's all mathematical. And the people who try to translate what's going on in contemporary physics into kind of everyday language are just speaking metaphorically. They can't tell us directly how physicists are thinking or what they're even talking to one another about. So you get things like string theory, but nobody can explain, you know, in popular language what that means. So you could get some revolutionary discovery in physics, which still kind of bypasses the majority of the public, because there's really no way to tell about it. And unless it has some real practical application to how we live. But I still think that's fascinating. I think you're very likely right. I just wonder if it would make any impact.
To Scott's point about whether it be positive or not. So, you know, the first thing could be just it's so indecipherable to the general public that it makes no impact. It could also, like that movie Don't Look Up on Netflix with Leonardo DiCaprio, it could be the kind of thing where, depending upon your political persuasion, you interpret it a completely different way, and it just furthers our divides. So I'm choosing to go positive here, fellas. So don't drag me down into the muck.
Good.
Well, we will end the predictions on that positive note, but we are going to ask Lawrence to stick around for a few more minutes and bring out his red pencil. Do you still use red pencils when you grade papers?
I grade a lot in D2L, which is our like online learning management system. So I in the margins and in Microsoft Word.
Okay, well, that's not how we did it when I was a kid. But
get off my lawn.
Bring out your virtual red pencil. I'm going to review the predictions Rick and I made last year, and I promise you, you can be a harsh grader. A to F is fine. No incompletes, because the year is coming quickly to a close. We did three predictions each last year. My first one, TikTok in the U.S., I said, will either be sold to an American-based company or banned.
I haven't followed this closely. I don't think either one of those things happened. Am I right about that?
That would be a big F. That would be a fail. And I was so I walked into this recording last year being so confident.
You are really proud of that prediction.
I was. So
I hate to give an F, but yeah, sorry.
That one failed. So this next one can be, I think, a little less harsh grading. But I said, with recent studies showing loneliness on the rise in America, people will start talking and perhaps even virtue signaling about how they're intentionally spending more time with others. What's your experience with that? Is that something, Laurent, you have seen in your corner of the world?
I mean, there certainly is this whole like industry of people on Instagram and TikTok and everywhere else, virtue signaling about being traditional and about, you know, not falling for 2023 trends. And there's all these trad accounts, you know, talking about living back on a farm and, you know, making organic food. And so I think you're on pretty solid ground with that prediction.
But as far as loneliness, though, I mean, that is something that we, I think, you know, you know this better than I do, but a lot of studies have shown people are lonelier than ever.
Yeah.
The pandemic kind of, you know, exacerbated that for lots of reasons we all know. And now that that's mostly behind us, I got this sense this would be the year people would come out of their shells, reunite and do all these things with all these people that they were wanting to do and be loud and proud about it. Do you think that happened?
I hate to give you a poor grade here, but I just saw another study recently about young men and how little they're dating and how they don't know how to talk to women and that kind of thing. So it almost seems like they've done the opposite. They've come out on social media and talked about how hard it is and then how difficult of a time they're having. So in that sense, yeah, I don't know that people are proudly saying they're doing the things that you think they should be doing in terms of—
I need a grade.
Darn it. I'll give you a 60, a D minus.
A D minus, okay. Well, that's better than the F. And then my final one, and again, I think I can grade myself on this, but I predicted confidently last year that there will be a major merger or acquisition of a streaming company. And there are some talks right now about who's going to end up owning Hulu, but was sort of a predicted thing because of some contract language that was set in place years ago. But, you know, Netflix and Amazon and Paramount and go down the list are all still there. I mean, I would give myself an F on this prediction. Do you agree?
Even though you did fail, I think you only failed because of the time constraints. I've read a number of articles on some of these streaming services. It seems like the bubble is about to burst.
Yeah.
And so I think you're just a little early on that prediction, but yeah.
That looked like a slam dunk last year when you made
it. I know. I mean, I just did not do well. Rick, do you want to go over your three predictions?
But have you guys seen the same reports I've seen that a lot of these streaming services really aren't sustainable?
Oh yeah. The two that are, you know, I mean, Netflix is doing actually a little better than maybe a year or two ago. Apple and Amazon, these are sort of side businesses for them. And Apple especially has so much money that they can keep this going for a long time. I think you'll see more of those two companies getting into live programming like sports. But yeah, as far as the Disney Pluses and the Hulus and the, you know, Stars and all these Showtimes, though, there's just so many out there. I think a lot of people hesitate to pay for all of them.
If only somebody could bundle all those together and like deliver them to your home,
like through maybe a cable of some sort,
like fiber optic or something.
Yeah, that. Well, who knows? Maybe someday if we keep our fingers crossed. Rick, what were your three from last year? Get ready. You'll do better than me.
Well, the first one is that AI will emerge as a major economic and cultural disruption. And at the time, ChatGPT wasn't all that old. We were still talking about, you know, the latest version of ChatGPT coming out.
Well, I mean, as Bill Clinton would say, it depends upon your definition here of disruption. It's certainly becoming integrated into society in really fascinating ways. We're seeing it in the college classroom. Some of our university presidents may or may not have used it to write some of their papers. It certainly has been very well integrated in a way that it wasn't a year prior. How disruptive? I don't know. I'd give you a good grade on that one, though. It's certainly become, it's going to have widespread application across a number of industries and fields and areas of social life. So
I know it got brought up in connection with the writer's strike in Hollywood, but I don't— was it a major factor in the writer's strike, or was it just one of
I mean, my understanding, a lot of it was around that and around what we just talked about a minute ago with the streaming services and sort of the payment models that were around then, because the syndication, you know, which was such a huge, and in some corners of the of TV still can be a big profit center, but we all know that's not going to last forever.
Tie in with your prediction and Scott's, which is, you know, the loneliest epidemic. The rise of chatbots and AI girlfriends and all that kind of stuff. So I certainly see this growing. I think it happened this year and it'll continue to grow next year.
We need a grade.
Can I give that one an A?
Oh my God.
Oh, look at that.
Look at that.
That's pretty good. I didn't think I'd get an A. I didn't think I'd worked hard enough on that one, but
what was your second prediction, Rick?
Second one is solar panel installations on private homes will double from 2 million to 4 million.
Oh, gosh. I don't even, I would need to research this one. Did it happen, I guess, would be the question.
Well, if you don't know, then yes.
Oh, okay. Well, Scott?
Well, I mean, I assumed that our professor would be doing the chat.
Oh, gosh. All right, let me pull up ChatGPT real quick. All right, ChatGPT.
Lawrence, I did look this up, and it was kind of hard to tell, but I think they increased by about 30%, which is really pretty far short of doubling.
Yes. So you get enough for that one. But A for effort.
Yes.
Yeah.
A for effort. But
F for substance. Yes.
But I bet your grade on your last prediction will not be an F.
I predicted that free speech would get more controversial.
Oh, gosh. A plus, 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 like in the Christmas Story. Plus, 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 yes. And only more so as more institutions and areas of social life become these battlefields for that. Absolutely.
And I didn't even picture, like, I didn't foresee at all, like, Elon Musk just destroying Twitter.
Had he bought Twitter when you made that prediction?
He had either bought it or he was in the process.
He was in talks
to buy it, you know, that sort of thing.
He bought it. I was at the end of October 2022.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think there's any question about this. And you know, as we become more partisan, you know, each side will want to attack the other side's, you know, interpretation of speech and discretion and indiscretions and that kind of stuff. So, absolutely.
Well, gentlemen, it's been fun. We'll have to see over the next 12 months how well our predictions do. I think we can agree that it would be great if some of them did come true, and frankly, it would be just fine with all of us if a few did it come true as well. But we will revisit this 12 months from now and see how we did. But again, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us, and if I haven't already, please, I hope both of you have a happy New Year.
Same to you. Happy holidays, fellas.
Yeah, same here.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And don't forget to check out Lawrence's Utterly Moderate podcast, and that can be found on those same platforms. For Rick Kite and Lawrence Eppert, I'm Scott Rodd. Thank you for joining us.
How's your money feeling? It's about to feel happier with a certificate from Happy Money's partner, Michigan State University Federal Credit Union. Elevate and increase your savings with 18-month terms and only a $500 minimum. And the happiest part? MSU FCU certificates yield 4.5% APY annual percentage yield. Now that's a happier side of money. Elevate your savings. Go to happymoney.com/MSUFCU. That's MSUFCU. Funds insured up to $250,000 by NCUA. The APY is accurate as of the 12/1/2023 dividend declaration date. Early withdrawal penalties do apply. Fees may reduce earnings on the account. Any monthly withdrawals or transfers reduce earnings.